Greetings and welcome to the War on Recess podcast. I'm your host, Walter Duncan. And in each episode, we will bring you true stories from frontline teachers and thought leaders that are transforming education for the 21st century. I need to warn you, these stories contain the good, the bad, and the ugly. They haven't been sanitized. And we do it this way out of our sincere desire that you, the listener, will find something of value that you can apply to your daily practice, whether it be in the boardroom, in the classroom, or just in your daily family life. We thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you enjoy today's podcast. Today's episode features a story from Al Elliott, a teacher from Birmingham, Alabama, with 23 years of classroom experience. In addition to being a teacher, Al is also a poet, a TEDx speaker, a musician, and an actor. You can see him featured in Marc Maron's newest film, The Sword of Trust, which will be making its debut at the South by Southwest Film Festival in spring 2019. Without further ado, we will let Al speak for himself with his story. The War on Recess podcast is sponsored by the Validated Learning Company, makers of the Quick Key mobile grading app, which eliminates the time that teachers spend marking and grading exams. Grading papers? Now there's an app for that. Download for free on the Apple App Store, Google Play, or directly at quickkeyapp.com. That's www.quickkeyapp.com.
My name is Al Elliott. I'm a school teacher, fifth grade. This is my 24th year as a classroom teacher. And this year I'm teaching science and social studies. My second year teaching ever, I taught math. And one of the, one of the pivotal stories or events that kind of changed how I view education was when I was teaching how to divide fractions, and I was using an algorithm, and a lot of times the way we teach it is we use the acronym KFC, which stands for keep the first one, flip the second one, and change the sign. Meaning, you know, you would just keep the first fraction, the numerator on the top, denominator on the bottom, and then find the reciprocal of the second fraction, thus flipping it over, and when you change the sign, it changed from a division sign to a multiplication sign, multiply straight across, and then you magically get your answer. So I had a student sitting in the back of the class, and he raised his hand, and he asked, why don't we just divide straight across? Now, to me, at the time, I wanted to, I guess, embarrass him into not asking no dumb questions. To me, that's what I thought I was trying to do. I didn't know he had been in the back of class dividing straight across, getting answers, and just kind of wanted to interpret his answers. And so I said, well, let's find out why it doesn't work. So I wrote a problem on the board and divided straight across, and we got the correct answer. And that's when I realized I didn't know the answer to the question that he asked. And the question that he asked was like the best question, like, of the whole like lesson. Like, why do we go through this algorithm to find the answer? Why does it work? Not necessarily that it works. Why does it work? This was my second year teaching. But the first year, I would go into a summer training program with what's called the Algebra Project with a guy named Robert Moses. But Robert Moses developed this math algebra project that he called a transitional curriculum for his own kids, because he found that they were having problems in mathematics when they went on to middle and high school, when they went on to algebraic math. But the problem that he discovered is that algebra is such an abstract science. All of the letters actually stand for something in reality. And really, if you think about all of mathematics, all of the numbers and numerals stand for something in reality. There's really no such thing as 2 plus 2 equals 4. two things plus two other things is equal to four things. You're counting something. If not, they're just abstract symbols. So when you get to algebra, the students have no physical reality to abstract from. And so the algebra will become more difficult and confusing. So what he figured out was if you gave the students a shared physical experience, they can create a symbolic representation to represent the shared physical experience, and then they can solve all sorts of problems. But then when they got to algebra, that was a familiar skill set, and they end up doing better in math. So that showed me the importance of shared physical experiences as it pertains to solving a problem in a group. A lot of times we don't realize when we speak to each other with words, we are abstracting our ideas, which are abstract. So it's an abstraction of an abstraction. There is nothing really concrete. But if we all go on a trip together, and let's say we go to the zoo, and then we go to the mall, and we come home, regardless if you enjoyed the zoo or not, or you know the mall or not, we know where we went. So that shared physical experience helps us be able to create the abstract language around it to solve problems associated with that. The curious thing that I learned from that was the reason why he chose math. Bob Moses was a civil rights worker, and he worked with a lot of civil rights workers. And so he discovered that if you taught young people how to solve problems in math, and they found success in it, they really didn't know another way to solve problems, period. And so they go out into the community and solve problems together. And so a lot of the young people that would be in these algebra project math programs would go out into the community and solve other problems together, but they would go and experience these physical experiences, and then when they go and plan the solution, they would have that shared physical experience to plot and be able to attack that problem. But it was also the exact same way that the civil rights movement actually worked. They would experience that problem together. So when they planned their attack, they had a shared physical experience by which to abstract from. So this has always been a central point for anything that I try to, move forward with, is what physically in reality actually transpired that is influencing what I'm considering to be a solution to a problem. So fast forward to the validating institution concept that I spoke about on my TEDx talk. And then basically it started with students cornering me and figuring out who my favorite students were, and me trying to convince them that they didn't know who my favorite students were. But it actually helped me realize that all of my students were my favorite students, just not at the same time. And it made me reflect and think of and a time when every student was actually my favorite student. Like I had a student, Jack, who basically said it was like the first day of school one year, and we were just talking about interesting things. And he shared that if you actually really still, you can actually feel the world turning. He'd done it before, which, okay, you're my favorite student at that point, if you've actually felt the world turning. But just also, I shared with that particular class that year that the assignment of, you know, write about what you want to be when you grow up. And I told them, don't worry about if you don't really know if you change your mind, because I used to want to teach kids how to ride bikes. I can remember learning how to ride a bike. And I was so excited. It was like the coolest thing. I was like, man, that's it. That's what I want to do for a living. I want to unlock the mystery of two-wheel transportation. That's what I'll do. So I really, like, when I was 10 years old, yeah, hey, what you want to be when you grow up? Man, I want to teach kids how to ride bikes. When I shared it with my students, their reaction was so surprising to me. They thought it was a great idea, started helping me come up with, like, company names, volunteering to come work on the weekend and help, you know, teach kids how to ride bikes. And it made me, like, feel great that they, you know, they thought this little silly idea I had was great, but it made me reflect and understand really two important things, right? One, how great it felt to have somebody like your idea. Like, it felt as good as having somebody like you. And also, like, as long as I'm learning in the classroom with them, they are my classmates. Like, we were learning together. So, you know, as opposed to thinking, what if I would have had these classmates back then? Where would I be today? It's kind of like you still had these classmates if you keep learning. Let me say this about students and listening to students. So a couple of years ago, I had a student named Melvin who, in his pastime, he liked looking up conspiracy theories. And so he came to me one day, he's very excited. And it was the end of a school day, and he said, "Mr. Elliott, I thought of a new conspiracy theory." I was like, "Cool, what conspiracy theory is it?" He said, "I learned about the Mandela effect." I said, "Okay, explain it. What's the Mandela effect?" He said, "It's kind of hard to explain." So it was the end of the day, and he left, and he came back the next day, and he said, "Mr. Elliott, I got it. I found a way to explain the Mandela effect." I said, "Okay, explain it." He said, "You know how in Star Wars, Darth Vader says, 'Luke, I'm your father'?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Darth Vader never says that." And I was kind of confused. He says, "The Mandela effect is when something is not true, but it's so widely accepted as true, it's treated as true." It actually came from Nelson Mandela being in prison so long, a lot of people assumed or thought that he was dead. And it was such a widely accepted phenomenon that when he really did get out, it was unbelievable to a lot of people. Now, the reason that was significant, because I learned it from a 10-year-old. And it reminded me of other things that I do in the community with people in their teens. My son is 19, but people that he would consider his peers in their 20s, 30s, I'm 46. And it helped me kind of understand that I believe that the generation gap is a Mandela effect. Like, I think that it is something that we think is true and we treat it as truth, but there's always been effective ways to pass information generationally. And so there must be an effective way to do that. So this gap that we see, I think, is just a perceived gap. And recess. So in the spirit of the podcast, the war on recess, I can remember, I teach at a school now and we have recess. I teach at an elementary school that has recess. And I know I have contemporaries and other teachers that teach at other schools. I left the school where we didn't have recess. And so I was having a conversation with a teacher, and they were explaining to me how they didn't see the point of recess because it's just they already have PE. And PE is a structured time, and recess is more of a non-structured time. One of the things that I know schools consistently teach a lot of kids and a lot of people in general is how to follow instructions. And I think that becomes problematic because later in life, when you don't have anyone to give you instructions, you're lost. You have no practice at inventing what to do. I think recess in a safer environment lets kids, for lack of a better phrase, kids be kids, interact, problems arise, and a lot of times they have to solve those problems and those interactions. They have to invent new ways and new pathways. And in that same format, when as a teacher something transitional happens, when I had this student ask me a question about why we don't divide straight across, like from that moment forward in my experience with the Alzheimer's Project, it made me want to listen to students' questions, to their curiosity, and kind of help that to lead a lesson. And so even as an adult, as a teacher, when something like that is unlocked in me, it kind of allows me to play in the playground in my mind to have kind of recess, like I've discovered this problem. I got this from a reality, a shared physical experience. How can we use that information to abstract a solution moving forward? Big shout out to Walter Duncan. I met him years ago. Tech conferences, using QuickKey. I used to present at a lot of tech conferences using his app, and he was always willing and ready to explain the technology. Somewhat of a tech head. So it kind of worked out to know that I wasn't the only one.
The War on Recess podcast is brought to you by the Validated Learning Company, where we're committed to supporting those who believe that all kids can learn and those who are willing to do whatever it takes to help students achieve at the highest level. To learn more about our work, visit us at www.quickkeyapp.com. That's www.quickkeyapp.com.